here we go. Some of you have heard of the Scopes monkey trial. That was a court case in the 1920s in the States where a teacher named Scopes was arrested for teaching evolution, and it went to civil court. And maybe you've seen a movie called Inherit the Wind, which is not very accurate, but gives the story of how the right to teach evolution was won in the 1920s. Well, if you're a conservative and sort of a Bible person, you would have said that the good guy in the case was Clarence Darrow. He was the lawyer who defended the schoolmaster Scopes. No, I want to say it the other way around. He would be the bad guy, right, because he defended the schoolmaster Scopes. So it doesn't matter. Anyway, Clarence Darrow has this to say, first word tonight on Jonathan Edwards. He says, "It's not surprising that Jonathan Edwards' main business in the world was to scare silly women and little children and blaspheming the God he professed to adore. Nothing but a disturbed or a diseased mind could have produced his Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God." And there Darrow refers to a sermon that Edwards preached called Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. Now, Darrow represents what might be called a majority opinion on this man, Jonathan Edwards, as the person responsible for this horrible thing called Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. Darrow saw him as a man of disturbed and diseased mind. And I would venture a guess that Mr. Darrow never did actually read a copy of the sermon, or he would not consider Edwards to be a man of a disturbed mind, but maybe that's not true. Certainly there are a lot of people like Clarence Darrow who consider Jonathan Edwards to be bad, bad news, and venture that opinion entirely on what they understand about one sermon preached in a long career of thousands of sermons preached. A Jonathan Edwards scholar of the 20th century named Ola Winslow sees him not as a man of diseased mind, but a man of a horrible theological system. And she says in a book, which actually has a lot of helpful facts about Jonathan Edwards, she says that Edwards was a prisoner in an outworn, obsolete theological system. His bondage, she says, seems almost a tragic pity. That's a minority view. There are people who see Edwards as a brilliant guy, but too bad about his theology, too bad about his view of God. For him to be harnessed with such a horrible view of God is a tragic pity. And the non-believing person, the non-Christian who's single-handedly most responsible for reintroducing society in the 20th century to Jonathan Edwards, a man named Perry Miller, who was a professor and who admired Edwards' philosophical abilities, said similarly, "The life of Edwards is a tragedy. Because of his faith, Jonathan Edwards wrought incalculable harm." And there again, Edwards a good man, but a bad faith did great harm to people because of the horrible things he believed. And everyone seems to want to get in the act. Phyllis McGinley is an American woman who wrote poetry for children. And she has a swipe at Jonathan Edwards as well. She writes about children who believe in the God of Mr. Edwards. Her poem written in 1961 goes like this. "And if they had been taught aright, small children carried bedwards would shudder lest they meet that night the God of Mr. Edwards. Abraham's God, the wrathful one, intolerant of error, not God the Father or the Son, but God the Holy Terror." And she talks about him again as a man devoted to terrorizing small children, and perhaps like the first author or the first person quoted, also silly women. Well, she reflects not so much a contempt for his mind or his theology, but for the Bible in general. She faults him for bringing forward notions about Abraham's God. And we who take the Bible at face value as the Word of God and would not shrink away from someone who introduces us to Abraham's God, because God is the same yesterday and today and forever, might have a different view of Jonathan Edwards just on the basis of the fact that we have a different view of the Bible. But we can go to someone who has a very high view of Scripture, a genuine Christian who has no aversion to the God of the Bible, and a person whose own theology is biblical enough not to be repulsed by what Edwards taught about God, and see what he thinks about Jonathan Edwards. And here's a 20th century expert on the subject of biblical theology. I'll identify him in a minute. And here's what he says about Edwards in contrast to what the vast majority of people say about Edwards. He says, "Let us look at this man who has had such a lasting influence and who seems to be becoming again almost a dominating influence in religious thought in America. I confess freely that this is one of the most difficult tasks I have ever attempted. The theme is almost impossible, and very largely for the reason that I've already given, namely the great influence of Edwards upon me. This is Martin Lloyd-Jones, the Welsh preacher, speaking. And he says, "I'm tempted, perhaps foolishly, to compare the Puritans to the Alps, Luther and Calvin to the Himalayas, and Jonathan Edwards to Mount Everest. He has always seemed to me to be the man most like the Apostle Paul. He stands out, it seems to me, quite on his own amongst men. So the task confronting me, if I may follow my analogy of Mount Everest, the task of anyone trying to convey the worth of this man to anyone else, is to decide whether to approach him by the south face or by the north face. It's the same as the task of deciding how to climb Mount Everest." He says, "There are so many approaches to this great summit, but not only so, the atmosphere is so spiritually rarefied, and there is this blazing whiteness of the holiness of the man himself, and his great emphasis upon the holiness and the glory of God, and above all, the weakness of the little climber as he faces this great peak pointing up to heaven. All I can hope to do is to give some glimpses of this man and his life and what he did, with the ultimate end and object of persuading everyone to buy these two volumes of his works and to read them." Martin Lloyd-Jones was speaking at a time when the only way to get to Edwards was to buy two of these things and read Edwards in this edition. And his hope, Martin Lloyd-Jones' hope, was that he could encourage some people to buy the big books. It was $100 a while ago, probably $150 now, and start the reading. Well, I don't need you to spend $150. I'll show you cheaper ways to get in on Edwards. But I feel the same way, that in terms of the value that I've gained from studying his stuff over couple of decades now, I would be thrilled to incline any of you to look to the man, to climb up Mount Everest and gain some things from him. This is extraordinary talk. This is highfalutin talk to elevate anybody other than Jesus himself with this kind of grand praise. So let me give some sort of justification for it. I'll just say that as you turn to your sheet, if you've got the front side of this sheet entitled "To Climb Up Mount Everest," there's two websites listed there, and you can now ignore the first one. CCEL stands for Christian Classics Ethereal Library, and I put that website on just because the Jonathan Edwards site was shut down. I'm glad to say it's now back up again, and so you can go to jonathanedwards.com and read to your heart's content without spending $150. You can also spend a little less than that and buy a Jonathan Edwards CD. It's advertised on that website, but all the works of Edwards are there for the downloading, and it's now free. To climbing up Mount Everest is now free. You'll have to excuse the sort of smarty-pants attitude of the guy who runs the Jonathan Edwards website. All you can say in regard to that is that at times he humbly apologizes for being a smart aleck. But he provides us with an opportunity to read Edwards free of charge if you're on the internet, and there you go. Let me give you a brief biography of Jonathan Edwards to know where he's coming from. You see this, no blanks to fill in. He was born in October of 1703 in East Windsor, Connecticut. That means a few things. That means that next year is the 300th anniversary of his birth. I'm just kind of thinking as a backdoor thought that if this series becomes enormously popular and, you know, we have to go to a second service in the evening and so on, maybe that would warrant spending next year, the year 2003, the 300th anniversary of Jonathan Edwards' birth, studying more works of Edwards. I've had these delusional kind of thoughts before, so it'll pass, but it is the 300th anniversary coming up. Being born in Connecticut in 1703, all those years before the Declaration of Independence, means that he was an Englishman, and indeed called himself an Englishman, living in an English colony, one of the colonies long before independence. If you asked him about Americans, he would think you meant First Nations peoples, Indians, and he did indeed live surrounded by Indians. He lived in a dangerous time. Neighboring villages, while he was growing up, were at times raided by Indians, and the villagers were scalped or led away into captivity, and the women were horribly treated, and the children were raised or in some other way taken over by the Indians. He lived in dangerous times. There was unrest in his part of the world. His father was a pastor, and he grew up being the only son of a pastor with 10 sisters. All his sisters grew to the remarkable height of 6 feet. And people used to talk about his father as Pastor Edwards and his 60 feet of daughters. Jonathan Edwards grew to be 6 feet tall as well, so he wasn't towered over by his sisters, but certainly surrounded by 10 sisters. His father at one point was recruited into service as an army chaplain and was involved in a raid north. Canada in those days was the property of the French. This was long before the Battle of the Plains of Abraham. So Canada was in the hands of the French, and the French were the bad guys. And Jonathan Edwards' father left home for a number of months, and was involved in what was to be an attack upon Louisbourg in an attempt to conquer Canada for the English. So you won't find any kind of relevant references to Canadians there. This is that long ago. He was a brilliant young kid. He was homeschooled by his father till the age of 12, and then at the age of 12 he was sent to Yale. You homeschool parents can try to match that. Off to Yale at the age of 12. And even as a very, very, very young kid, he showed a remarkable intellect and, in fact, a pretty intriguing sense of humor. Funny kid. There's a scrap of paper left over written, obviously, when he just learned to write. So what would he be, 4 or 5 or 6 years old? And it's a treatise mocking a concept he heard from somebody. Somebody had written about the fact, the view that the soul has a material presence, that your soul has some sort of material reality and stays by the corpse after you die. And here he is at the age of 4 or 5 or 6 or 7 writing, "I am informed that you've advanced a notion that the soul is material and attends the body till the resurrection. As I am a professed lover of novelty, you must imagine I am very much entertained by this discovery, which, however old in some parts of the world, is new to us. But suffer my curiosity a little further. I would know the manner of the kingdom before I swear allegiance." Here he is at 4 or 5 or 6 years old, sounding brilliant. And he had a brilliant career before him as a scientist. He was extremely interested in the natural world. He began to write doctrinal essays on spiders and rainbows and natural world. He had the potential to become a mighty physicist or a naturalist of some sort, and probably would have, except that a higher calling grabbed him. He remained a funny guy. You never see that in the caricatures of him as the author of Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. But you read his memoirs, you read his journals, you see he was brilliant enough to have a great sense of humor. When he was 16 years old, he wrote to one of his sisters. He has 10 sisters, right? And the tongue-in-cheek is just really quite notable. He's writing to a sister who hasn't written to him for a while. And he says, "Dear sister, of all the many sisters I have, I think I've never had one so long out of my hearing as yourself, inasmuch as I cannot remember that I ever heard one tittle from you from the time you last went up the country until the last week." And it's a funny letter that shows you that he wasn't a dull guy. He wasn't a dull genius. He was a witty, funny, sparkling kind of guy with a brilliant intellect. And at 12 years old, he's a student at what became Yale. And he exceeded all his classmates and was a very brilliant guy. At the age of 19, he was appointed to be the pastor of a church in New York City. He went there for 8 months. Scotch Presbyterian Church. Not much, we don't know much about that, except it didn't work out for him. And after just a few months, after 8 months, he went back to Yale and did graduate work. And then, in 1727, when he was, you do the math, he's 24 years old, he went to the Congregational Church in Northampton, Massachusetts, where his grandfather had been the pastor for many decades. And he served as his grandfather's associate pastor for a couple of years until 1729, when his grandfather died. And then he took over the church and became the revered pastor of the Congregational Church from 1727 to 1750. And then in a turn of events which would curl the blood or the hair, if he had, of any pastor, 1750, his congregation turned against him. And there's a long series of mishaps and misunderstandings that went on with that. But his church had a congregational meeting in 1750 and voted overwhelmingly in favor of dismissing him. So they fired him after whatever that is, 23 years of faithful service. And then they couldn't find an interim pastor. So he stayed on as his own interim pastor and preached to a congregation that mostly hated him for a while. And it was a horrible and tragic thing. He took a church in, if you could call it that, in a wilderness colony of Stockbridge, way west of Northampton in the colony of Massachusetts. It's really just an Indian outpost, and went from this pretty prestigious place in Northampton to this nowhere place in Stockbridge for 8 years. And it was in the providence of God that he did so, because while he was there, pastoring a very small group of people and a bunch of Indians who weren't all that interested in what he was explaining, he had tons of time. I suppose I'm going to get in trouble for sounding racist or something with those remarks. First Nations people who were not regular church attenders is what I meant to say. And while he had all this extra time on his hands, he began to turn to some of the intellectual interests that he had, and most of his major works were written in that period. A very important thing on original sin, which is sort of the sticking point for many people in terms of biblical theology. He wrote an exhaustive and convincing essay on the freedom of the will. He didn't write Religious Affections. He had written that already in the 1740s, as we'll see part of his pastoral work. He stayed there in the wilderness for 8 years, and then in 1758, very reluctantly, accepted the presidency of Princeton. Princeton University elected him to be president. He was reluctant to go, but that's because he was a humble, sort of private person and didn't want to get into public life. But against his own misgivings, he went. He became the president of Princeton. In some of the old books, you'll read about him as President Edwards, and they're referring to the fact that he had been elected president of this very important university, Princeton. He was always interested in science, and he heard about a new scientific thing called inoculation. Smallpox was a deadly disease, and he thought he'd step up to bat and be inoculated against smallpox as a sort of scientific experiment that he would have run on himself. So he went for a smallpox shot after he got to Princeton, and it sort of backfired. It produced pustules in his throat, which made it impossible for him to drink, and he got very, very sick, and he couldn't drink any water, and he basically died of thirst in 1758. In what looked like a strange and tragic bit of bad luck, but he would be the first one to say there's no such thing. He died on March 22nd, 1758, at the age of 52 or 53, whatever that works out to be, and that was the end of him. But it's not the end of him, because he left behind a legacy of literature and works which can be extremely helpful to anyone who will take the time to plow past the caricature of him as some wild, demented man who scared silly women and children, and read what he actually wrote. Let me explain to you in a couple of ways his importance. And in doing this, I'll introduce you to the man by reading some of the things he wrote about his own spiritual experience. I've got two ways in which he's important to us, but for me, there's actually three. And in the first place, which is not here in the notes, he's important to me because he was an all-round man. He was a husband, and his marriage was rich and wonderful and never ceased to be until the day he died. He was a father, and like his father before him, had 11 children, but he balanced the books a little better. He had 3 sons and 8 daughters, and they grew up with father as pastor. And what's very appealing to me is that none of his kids hated him for that, or hated God for that, or hated the church for that. They all grew up to love the Lord, and this has always been to me a very arresting thing about him. He was a successful father, he was a good husband, and he was a great pastor. He did not ignore his church family. He did a good job of pastoring. So to me, he's the balanced guy. He's the Renaissance guy. And yet, while being a pastor and a husband and a father, he never pleaded too busy to be on with the important things. And here are the two important things that we should consider and understand to see his importance. He was, in the first place, a Christian of profound spiritual understanding and profound spiritual experience. He was not a professional, so to speak, not just a man who talked about God because he was being paid to, which is an occupational hazard that every pastor must confront. He was, in the first place, a lover of God. And that came out of his profound spiritual experience. And I would say, personal opinion, that his profound spiritual experience and his profound spiritual understanding centered on 3 things, which I think really typify what he's all about. And you can pick up some insight and some experience about these things from him. This is what you'll catch from Edwards if you take the time to read. The first thing is the glory of God. And I'd like to have you enter Edwards' experience by reading a couple of passages on the glory of God and these other topics. Here's Edwards on the glory of God, writing for himself, for his own records in his memoirs, not thinking that this would be published ever. Here's what he says. You get a sense for how deeply he experienced the glory of God. He says, "The first instance that I remember of that sort of inward sweet delight in God and divine things that I've lived much in since was on reading these words from 1 Timothy. Now unto the King eternal, immortal, invisible, the only wise God, be honor and glory forever and ever. Amen. As I read the words, there came into my soul and was, as it were, diffused through it a sense of the glory of the divine being, a new sense, quite different from anything I've ever experienced before. Never any words of Scripture seemed to me as these words did. I thought with myself how excellent a being that was, and how happy I should be if I might enjoy that God and be wrapped up to Him in heaven, and be, as it were, swallowed up in Him forever. I kept saying, and as it were, singing over these words of Scripture to myself, and went to pray to God that I might enjoy Him, and prayed in a manner quite different from what I used to do, with a new sort of affection. But it never came into my thought that there was anything spiritual or of a saving nature in this." And at this point you go, what? Here's his deep, profound spiritual experience, and as a sidebar, he says, but it never occurred to me that this was a saving thing. This is an experience of God, but not necessarily a saving thing. And here he begins to hint at what the book Religious Affections is all about, that you can have deep, profound spiritual experiences and yet not be saved. And it requires huge discernment, very, very important discernment to understand the difference between experiences which unsaved people can have of God and experiences that saved people can have, and that's what Religious Affections is about. But I digress. Here he goes. He says, from about that time, I began to have a new kind of apprehensions and ideas of Christ and the work of redemption and the glorious way of salvation by Him. An inward, sweet sense of these things at times came into my heart, and my soul was led away in pleasant views and contemplations of them. And my mind was greatly engaged to spend my time in reading and meditating on Christ, on the beauty and excellency of His person, and the lovely way of salvation by free grace in Him. I found no books so delightful to me as those that treated of these subjects. So he wonders what to make of this experience, of this new sweetness about God. He says, not long after I first began to experience these things, I gave an account to my father of some things that had passed in my mind. I was pretty much affected by the discourse we had together, and when the discourse was ended, I walked abroad alone in a solitary place in my father's pasture for contemplation. And as I was walking there and looking upon the sky and clouds, there came into my mind so sweet a sense of the glorious majesty and grace of God as I know not how to express. I seemed to see them both in a sweet conjunction, majesty and meekness joined together. It was a sweet and gentle and holy majesty, and also a majestic meekness, an awful sweetness, a high and great and holy gentleness. After this sense of divine things gradually increased and became more and more lively and had more and more of that inward sweetness, the appearance of everything was altered. There seemed to be, as it were, a calm, sweet cast or appearance of divine glory in almost everything. God's excellency, His wisdom, His purity and love seemed to appear in everything, in the sun, moon and stars, in the clouds and blue sky, in the grass, the flowers, the trees, in the water, and all nature, which used greatly to fix my mind. I often used to sit and view the moon for a long time, and in the day spent much time in viewing the clouds and sky to behold the sweet glory of God in these things. In the meantime, singing forth with a low voice my contemplation of the Creator and Redeemer. And scarce anything among all the works of nature was so sweet to me as thunder and lightning. Formerly, nothing had been so terrible to me. Before, I used to be uncommonly terrified with thunder and to be struck with terror when I saw a thunderstorm rising. But now, on the contrary, it rejoiced me. I felt God, if I may so speak, at the first appearance of a thunderstorm, and I used to take the opportunity at such times to fix myself in order to view the clouds and see the lightnings play and hear the majestic and awful voice of God's thunders, which oftentimes was exceedingly entertaining, leading me to sweet contemplations of my great and glorious God. While thus engaged, it always seemed natural for me to sing or chant forth my meditations or to speak my thoughts in soliloquies with a singing voice. Here's a man who had deep, profound appreciation of God, a sweet spiritual sense of God, and his writings smack of it. His writings pass that on to him. He had a big, big view of God. And with his big, big view of God came an understanding of a big topic about God, which is very important for any person serious about the Bible to come to terms with, and that's the sovereignty of God. And here's a snippet of his explanation of that, not as long a reading as this previous one. Here he is on the sovereignty of God. From my childhood up, my mind has been full of objections against the doctrine of God's sovereignty in choosing whom He would to eternal life and rejecting whom He pleased, leaving them eternally to perish and be everlastingly tormented in hell. So this will be a consolation to some of you. He started with a great abhorrence of the idea of God being in control. It used to appear like a horrible doctrine to me. But I remember the time very well when I seemed to be convinced and fully satisfied as to this sovereignty of God and His justice in thus eternally disposing of men according to His sovereign pleasure. But never could give an account how or by what means I was thus convinced, not in the least imagining at the time, nor a long time after, that there was any extraordinary influence of God's Spirit in it, but only that I now saw further, and my reason apprehended, the justice and reasonableness of it. However, my mind rested in it, and it put an end to all those cavils and objections. And there has been a wonderful alteration in my mind with respect to the doctrine of God's sovereignty from that day to this, so that I scarce ever have found so much as the rising of an objection against it in the most absolute sense in God showing mercy to whom he will show mercy and hardening whom he will. God's absolute sovereignty and justice with respect to salvation and damnation is what my mind seems to rest assured of as much as anything that I see with my eyes. At least it is so at times. But I've often, since that first conviction, had quite another kind of sense of God's sovereignty than I had then. I've often since had not only a conviction, but a delightful conviction. The doctrine has very often appeared exceedingly pleasant to me, bright and sweet. Absolute sovereignty is what I love to ascribe to God. But my first conviction was not so. So here he's very helpful to us, because in this great view of God's, in this view of God's greatness, he comes to terms with and peace with and even a delight in the absolute sovereignty of God. But he can help us with that, because at the start he didn't like it at all. He thought it was a horrible thing that God was in control of all things. But as he got to know how great God was, he got to be at peace with it, and he got to delight in it. And he can help us in that way. There's still the fact of the sermon, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. And I'd want to say, as a sidebar, you got to read the sermon to understand that it's not what people think. It's not this horrible God who's delighting to torture people. Quite the opposite. It's a God who has these sinners in his hands, and he's angry at what they're doing. Like Kevin was talking about the skunk, he hates sin, and he smells it for what it is, but he doesn't let them go. He's holding the sinners. Now, he's holding them over the pit of hell, it's true. And it's about the reality of hell, but that's the biblical reality that Edwards faithfully declared to his people. But it's still God holding them. They're in his hands. They're in the hands of a God who's angry, but not at this point letting them go. But that sermon, as much as it's just a part of his whole teaching, comes out of his view of this third thing which we can catch from him, and that's his profound grasp of the sinfulness of sin. So he's got this big, big view of God, high view of God, and he's got this low, low view of sin. And so he should. He can help us with this. We are, you know, God showed himself to Isaiah, and Isaiah says, "Woe is me, for I'm a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips." Well, if we had an Isaiah experience, I'm afraid that we would say, "Woe is me, for I'm a silly, flippant person, and I live in a generation of silly, flippant people." And we are so silly and flippant, you know, being raised on situation comedies and being so addicted to one-liners and laughs, that we have a hard time getting an appropriately serious view of God, and so a hard time getting an appropriately horrified view of sin. Edwards can help us with that. Listen to this. Now he was a good guy, right? I mean, he did not have any secret habits. He was not indulging in any kind of fleshly horrible indulgences or anything like that. He didn't stink like a skunk. But as he got to know God, it changed his view of himself. And here's what he says. He says, "Often since I lived in this town, I've had a very affecting view of my own sinfulness and vileness, very frequently to such a degree as to hold me in a kind of loud weeping, sometimes for a considerable time together, so that I've often been forced to shut myself up. I have had a vastly greater sense of my own wickedness and the badness of my heart than ever I had before my conversion. It's often appeared to me that if God should mark iniquity against me, I should appear the very worst of all mankind, of all that have been since the beginning of this world to this time, and that I should have by far the lowest place in hell. When others that have come to talk with me about their soul concerns have expressed the sense they have had of their own wickedness by saying that it seemed to them that they were as bad as the devil himself, I thought their expression seemed exceedingly faint and feeble to represent my wickedness. My wickedness, as I am in myself, has long appeared to me to be perfectly ineffable and swallowing up all thought and imagination like an infinite flood or like mountains on my head. I know not how to express better what my sin appears to me to be than by heaping infinite upon infinite and multiplying infinite by infinite." Now, you're clear on the fact, this is his private journal, right? He never meant this to be published. This is just him musing over what he sees in his own heart, and he writes it for his own edification. He says, "Very often for these many years, these expressions are in my mind and my mouth, infinite upon infinite, infinite upon infinite. When I look into my heart and take a view of my wickedness, it looks like an abyss, infinitely deeper than hell. And it appears to me that were it not for free grace, exalted, and raised up to the infinite height of all the fullness and glory of the great Jehovah, and the arm of his power and grace stretched forth in all the majesty of his power and in all the glory of his sovereignty, if it were not for that, I should appear sunk down in my sins below hell itself, far beyond the sight of everything but the eye of sovereign grace that can pierce even down to such a depth. And yet, it seems to me that my conviction of sin is exceedingly small and faint. It's enough to amaze me that I have no more sense of my sin. I know certainly that I have very little sense of my sinfulness. When I have had turns of weeping and crying for my sins, I thought I knew at the time that my repentance was nothing. in comparison to my sin. I've greatly longed of late for a broken heart. I look at that and I think, what a flimsy and superficial man I am. And here he is crushed by the weight of his sin, and he's longing for an appropriately broken heart. What would he think of a flaky kid like me? He says, I've greatly longed of late for a broken heart to lie low before God. And when I ask for humility, I can't bear the thoughts of being no more humble than other Christians. It seems to me that though their degrees of humility may be suitable for them, yet it would be a vile exaltation of myself not to be the lowest in humility of all mankind. Others speak of their longing to be humbled to the dust. That may be a proper expression for them, but I always think of myself that I ought, and it's an expression that's long been natural for me to use in prayer, to lie infinitely low before God. And it is affecting to think how ignorant I was when a young Christian of the bottomless, infinite depths of wickedness, pride, hypocrisy, and deceit left in my heart. And I'll just stop there. He goes on as he's coming to terms with the fact that to see how great and holy God is, and God has a good sense of smell, is to see how rank and stinking our sinfulness is in all of our pride and our self-exaltation and our smugness. And well, he can help us with that. Reading Edwards is an opportunity to sit at the feet of someone whose knowledge of God is deep and profound and all experienced. No theory here. It's experienced knowledge. And his experience is all grounded in knowledge, in a deep knowledge of the glory of God and the sovereignty of God and the sinfulness of sin. Just turn here for a moment to Martin Lloyd-Jones again and let him summarize the importance of this man as someone whose experience can benefit us. He says, he was a phenomenon. He says, he was born in a comparatively isolated area, and yet he stands out as a sheer genius, ridiculing any notions of evolution or the theory of acquired characteristics and so on. He was an original, suddenly shot forth, a mighty intellect accompanied by a brilliant imagination, amazing originality, but above all, honesty. He's one of the most honest Bible teachers I've ever read. He never evades a problem. He faces them all. He doesn't skirt around a difficulty. He had this curious interest in truth in all its aspects. And then with all those scintillating gifts, there's his humility and his modesty, and added to that his exceptional spirituality. He knew more about experienced religion than most men, and he placed great emphasis upon the heart. In other words, what strikes one about Edwards as one looks at the man as a whole is the completeness, the balance. He was a mighty theologian and a great evangelist at the same time. How foolish we've become. This man was both, as was the Apostle Paul. He was also a great pastor. He dealt with souls and their problems. He was equally expert with adults as with children. He was a great defender of conversion in children. He paid great attention to children, even allowing them to have meetings of their own. He seems to be everything and to be perfectly balanced. What then was the secret of this man? I have no hesitation in saying this. The spiritual always controlled the intellectual in him. I believe he must have had a great struggle with his towering intellect and his original thinking. Moreover, he was a voracious reader, and it would have been the simplest thing in the world for such a man to have become a pure intellectual. But theology kept breaking in. But what constitutes the special glory of this man, and this is what explains him, that he always kept his philosophy and his speculations subservient to the Bible. He regarded them as mere servants. Whatever he might be tempted to think, the Bible was supreme. Everything was subordinate to the Word of God. All his rich and brilliant gifts were not only held to be subservient, but they were used as servants. In other words, he was God-dominated. Someone has said of him that he combined passionate devotion and a profoundly integrated mind. So he's a Christian of profound spiritual understanding, profound spiritual experience. He's secondly a physician of the soul. And as a physician of soul, that's what pastors thought of themselves in those days. As a soul doctor, he was a student of two things that should be of interest to us. He was a student of revival. He was a student of the experience by which many people are swept into the kingdom. This is something that some of us long for and know to pray for. And if it were to happen, it would raise all kinds of questions which Edwards can answer. Works of his, writings of his, which you can find on the internet that address the idea of revival, include Some Thoughts Concerning the Present Revival of Religion in New England. There's a title that you can find on the internet. And A Faithful Narrative of the Surprising Work of God. And you read those works, and they'll give you insight into what to make of what's going on in the world today. You want to know what to make of Benny Hinn? You see that man on television, and you wonder, is that the power of God? If it is, is it the power of God used properly? Edwards can help you. He's this great man of God who saw revival in his day, who saw that sort of thing going on, and he made sense of it. He made biblical sense of it. So you wonder what to make of the airport non-vineyard thing that's going on. Interestingly, the airport people, as they explain what's going on, use Edwards. I would say, from my understanding, they misquote Edwards a lot. They misuse Edwards, but they refer to Edwards as a vindication of what's going on at the airport. And you read Edwards, it'll help you understand what's going on at the airport. And he can help you with that because he's an expert on revival. He's also an expert on conversion. And under the heading of the student of conversion and the nature of conversion, he's written this thing that we will look at in the weeks to come, a treatise concerning religious affections. Appreciating religious affections is a matter of understanding this, according to Martin Lloyd-Jones. It's a series of sermons on one verse, 1 Peter 1:8. I refer to that verse this morning. Though you've not seen him, you love him. And though you do not see him now, but believe in him, you greatly rejoice with joy inexpressible and full of glory. That's the verse that the whole work is based on. And what he does in these books, Lloyd-Jones says, is to show the difference between the true and the false in the realm of experience. He shows the difference between the true and the false in the realm of experience. Now, strangely, for this introduction to religious affections, I'm not going to tell you anything about religious affections tonight. I just wanted to give you a jump start on doing the work involved in understanding. But let me just say this in closing. Since there's such a thing as conversion, since there is such a thing as genuine conversion, and since there is such a thing as false conversion, where are you going to turn to understand rightly the difference between true conversion and false conversion? And I would say you better turn to an expert. You better turn to a man who's steeped in his own spiritual experience, who has this great, great understanding of God, who has this huge intellect, who's humbled before God, who understands the Bible, and who has seen conversions, both false and true. Best yet, who's seen revival, where hundreds of people are converted at a time, and he has lots and lots of cases to study. This is what religious affections is about. He wrote it in the 40s, in the 1740s, when a mighty conversion had occurred for the second time in his ministry. There was a conversion in 1735, and then there was another conversion in 1740. And in the space of about 6 months, these numbers don't sound big, but actually they're huge. Think about it. In the space of 6 months, the church had 300 people converted. 300 conversions, but like huge, earth-shaking, mind-boggling conversions. 300 people who didn't used to have any interest in God suddenly in the church over a six-month period. And he was there in 1735 when it happened, and he was there again in 1740 when it happened, and he had lots of experience, lots of opportunity to understand the difference between real conversion and false conversion. And he says that the difference has to do with affections, religious affections. And I'll begin to explain what that means next week. But here's what I've got for you in the meantime. If you turn the sheet over, there by James Houston, who was a professor at Regent College in Vancouver, notes about the relevance of this classic. Here's a brief summary of the religious affections. If you want to get your feet wet without going to the website or actually starting to read the thing, you could read this page and come to understand what you got. And on the literature table, as you go out tonight, there'll be a green sheet with my own summary of the three parts of religious affections. It'll show you what we're going to look at next week, because next week we'll do part one, which is really complicated stuff, and I'm trying to get you running at it so you can stick with me as we plow through part one. It's really difficult reading. Wouldn't recommend you go to the website and just try to understand this without some momentum going. And then part two, showing what are not signs that religious affections are truly gracious, we'll spend 5 weeks on. And we won't take it in the order. It's got 12 points. You'll find this really, really insightful, hair-raising, if you've got hair, mind-boggling kind of stuff. We'll take 5 weeks on it, and if it has an effect on you as it will have on me, I would only say to you, please hang on for part three. Because in part three, and we'll take 5 weeks on his 14 points of part three, he'll show what are distinguishing signs of truly gracious and holy affections. What he's going to show you is that some of the things that you cling to as the best evidence that you truly are saved are not worth clinging to, because they are not unique to those who are truly Christians. And some of the parts of your spiritual life that perhaps you're neglecting are the things that are actually evidence that God's working in you. And I mean, he's an expert. He can give you ideas on this. So I'd count it a great privilege to have you hang in here with me for whatever that is, 8 weeks or something. That'll take us September, October, November to get through most of that with a few interruptions along the way. But it would be my great privilege to introduce you to this great man for all the reasons that this great man is worth studying, primarily the opportunity to grow wise in the things of God and to make sense of your own spiritual experience and to become helpful as a, if not a physician of the soul, at least a first aid expert of the soul, and turning to other people and helping them. This will equip you to help other people make sense of their own a spiritual experience or lack of spiritual experience. So there it is. I thought I'd go on too long, and I did. I'll put the green sheets on the literature table so they're here for you, and then I'll come back up here and talk to anybody who wants to talk privately. It's now time to apologize to the good people who look after our kids. So as you go and relieve them, tell them it's all my fault, as usual, and thanks for being here tonight. The Lord be with you.